Welcome to Destination Murder, the true crime podcast.
Each week the hosts, that's us, BFS Megan
and Tegan,
cover stories from a new part of the world.
Get ready to combat your travel bug and feed your true crime obsession.
Hey Tegan, welcome back.
Hi Megan, thank you so much for having me on your podcast again. It really feels like it's been forever.
It does. I was thinking we've had not even a 2 week break, and it feels like I haven't done this in months.
I know. We literally took one weekend off and I'm like, how do we do this again? I forget.
Yeah. I mean, Sunday is usually my editing day. And so last Sunday I literally sat in front of the couch and watched Criminal Minds for hours and did not do anything. And it was so nice. But the entire time I was thinking, I was like, I feel like I need to be doing something right now. What am I supposed to be doing? And then I realized, I was like, oh, it's because I haven't had like a fully free Sunday in so long.
Yeah.
So it was very nice.
Ridiculous. Yeah, we didn't record last week. It's my fault. I went to go see my parents for the first time in 6 months. So I too kind of just sat on the couch with my family for 4 days and my puppy and did absolutely nothing. And it was nice. Yes. It was good to see them. I think it's so weird because like the entire time I'm like super happy to be there, and then like as soon as I'm getting out of the car to leave, I just like have to like hold back crying. I'm like, what? What? I'm like, don't cry, don't cry, don't cry. But yeah, it was hard to say goodbye, and hopefully I'll get to see them a little bit sooner, rather than later. But yeah.
Well, nice that you got a visit.
Yeah, I'm happy. Happy. And my dog Daisy was so excited to see me. She like, I opened the car door and she saw me coming and she just like full on jumped on me. I got kisses, from her for like the 30 minute drive back to my parents' place. She Aww. Was just like all over me and she slept with me every night. So I'm That's happy.
So cute. Well, I guess we better introduce the show. This is Destination Murder, the true crime podcast where we cover another case from a different country, state, city, province, etc. each week, and at the end of each week we pick another one from a hat, from a random number generator, random country generator, and that's where we go next week. So this week I think Tegan's up first.
I am up first. I would also like to say that this podcast includes a lot of our gossiping in it as well, so
yeah. Yeah, we do have Instagram at Destination Murder Pod. We've got Twitter at @dest_murder. And I think that's like all the social media stuff we have.
We Give have us a Facebook.
Follow, share. Oh, yeah. I always forget about Facebook.
Oh, Megan.
It's just Destination Murder on Facebook, I think.
Yeah. We have an email account that's not social media, but if you want to email us, you can.
Feel free.
We love it. It makes us so happy when we get emails from you guys. Yeah. So
I think that's dest.murder@gmail.com. Everything is just in our episode description. Follow us and you'll stay updated with the pod.
Yeah. And get content from us throughout the week because we like to post a lot of things.
But yeah, you're up next. Where are you taking us?
I am taking us to Algeria this week. And my case is going to be a little bit short because I forgot how to do things.
Yeah, fair.
But also, the case that I found that I wanted to do, there wasn't a ton of information on.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that. So I'm doing the death of Ali Boumengel. My sources this week are BBC, Wikipedia, and my favorite, the New York Times. So before we get into my case, I just wanted to give a couple key dates regarding France in Algeria.
Okay, let me take my notepad out.
Okay, are you ready? There will be an exam at the end of this, Megan.
Okay.
In the year 1830, France occupies the Algiers. 1848, after an uprising led by leader Abdelkader, Paris declares Algeria to be an integral part of France. 1940, France falls to Germany in World War II. 1942, Allies land in Algeria. 1945, Allied forces defeat Germany. Thousands are killed in pro-independence demonstrations in Sétif. From 1954 to 1962 is the Algerian War. And in 1962, Algeria becomes an independent state. So I will be talking a little bit about what happened in the Algerian War. So born in Relizane to an educated family from Beni Yenni region, which I think is an amazing name, Ali was educated at the Duver College in Blida. He oriented his career towards law at the beginning, and then he became a journalist for Eglat. There's my French doing absolutely no help for me. The Eglite Journal. During the revolution, he became one of many lawyers working for the Algerian nationalists. In 1955, he joined the National Liberation Front with his old friend Albain Ramdain, who he went to law school with. After Albain was released from prison during the revolution, Albain advised Ali to change his profession so he joined the litigation department of Shell Corporation while still continuing his militantism in the FLN. So started out as a lawyer, became a journalist, then got super involved in the independence kind of thing, and then went back to law to help people out. However, on March 23rd, 1957, he was thought to have committed suicide after jumping from the 6th floor of a building.
Oh.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry. Did he actually, like, fall from the building?
Plot twist.
It wasn't him?
He was pushed. So for decades, and despite the persistent pressure from the lawyer's late widow, Malika, France clung to the story that the death was a suicide. It did so even after the French army general Paul Assurez admitted in a book published in 2001, confessing to ordering the killing of dozens of Algerian prisoners, including Ali.
Hmm.
60 years later, France has admitted that the prominent Algerian nationalist was tortured and murdered by its army.
I saw something, I think it was like an article, and it was like all of the times that France has assassinated the leader of a country in Africa so that they can continue to control the country, and they like stifle the Republic uprising or whatever.
Yeah, I was quite surprised when I was kind of doing the research that there has been a lot of people that France is like just coming now to say, yes, we did order a hit on them. Like, there's a whole bunch of, I guess during the Algerian War, they killed a whole bunch of people and then just were like, no, we didn't do that. Something else happened to them. It's fine. It wasn't us.
It's like the U.S. and South America.
But I totally did not understand that for a second. My brain was like, South Korea?
No. It's like the U.S. just like assassinating every South American leader that starts to want to set up like socialism or whatever. Yeah. They're like, nope, that's not good for us.
Actually,
you're done.
We're gonna say no. So Ali was imprisoned by the French He was captured on February 5th, 1957, during the Battle of Algiers, and he was held in secret for 43 days. Which, to me, I'm like, okay, he was held for over a month. So, and then just, like, he shows up randomly committing suicide off of a building. Like, where did his family think that he was? Like, I don't understand.
It's also very suspicious.
Yeah, like, clearly, like, something happened to him if he just disappeared for, like, almost 2 months. And then...
And he's, like, a high-profile political person. Yeah. And he just disappears.
Like...
And then reappears only to die.
Yeah. Random. They didn't really go about that very well, in my opinion.
No.
They could have covered it up a little bit better. So in a meeting with Ali's grandchildren, President Emmanuel Macron reassessed the death, just telling them he did not commit suicide. He was tortured and then killed. So Ali was detained during the Battle of Algiers and was placed in solitary confinement by the French troops. The activist was then killed and thrown from the sixth floor building in an effort to disguise his death as suicide. Mr. Macron later said the latest admission was made in the name of France. The rare act is one of a series of measures aimed in improving relations between France and Algeria and the way that both countries remember the war that ended colonial rule. Which I think is funny because it's like, we're just trying to make it better for how we remembered it happened. Like,
yeah.
We're both going to have, two countries are going to have different views, and saying, yes, we actually did do that is not going to solve it. The conflict has cast a long shadow, and it is only in the recent years that France has begun to acknowledge some of the instances of torture and abuse. There are conflicting reports about the Algerian death toll during the war. French historians estimate that up to 400,000 Algerians were killed, while the Algerian government says that more than 1.5 million people died. So that's pretty off.
Yeah.
Two
different accounts.
Yeah, that's like triple. But the president has faced a backlash earlier when he refused to issue an official apology for the crimes committed during the conflict. He said that there would be no repentance nor apologies, rather symbolic acts aimed at promoting reconciliation, which I think is weird. Like, we're not going to apologize, but we're going to do symbolic acts.
Yeah. That's like, it's like almost like a legal disclaimer. It's like, we're not admitting guilt, but we'll help you, you know, move forward from this.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, just apologize and move on.
Yeah. He agreed to form a truth commission aimed at shedding lights on the conflict after the government commissioned report recommended doing so. But the report has since been criticized by the Algerian government, which said it was not objective and fell far below expectations. And that is my very short case of Ali Boumendjel.
Wow.
Very short.
Oh, stuff like that grinds my gears. It makes me so mad because, like, nearly every European country committed atrocities like that in the name of benefiting themselves. And then when it comes down to recognizing the trauma that they create, the trauma that they induced on all of these countries and all of these civilizations, they're like, oh, yeah, we kind of did hurt you a little bit, but, you know, it wasn't actually our fault, or, yeah. It draws me up the wall.
Yeah, and it's interesting to, like, see, like what comes to light at the end of the day. It's very interesting to me, because I wonder how he actually died, because if he was tortured... Like, how was he murdered? And then how was throwing his body out of a window going to cover up his murder?
Well, I mean, if France still if France was still in control of the country, then they would have had the power to
sweep it,
conceal it, because they were controlling the official documents and the official story. So they just had to have him spotted, quote unquote, jumping out of the window, and then they could continue their narrative after that.
Yeah. Very true.
Mm-hmm. Shall we go to Mexico now?
Yes, let's shall.
Mm-hmm. Good job. I don't want to say I love hearing cases like that, because it makes me feel really horrible for humanity.
Yeah.
But it's very important to recognize the injustices that world powers place on who they exploit.
Yeah, and I think that a lot of the cases that I've been doing recently have all been related to wars, and I just because that's the only thing that I can find, and it just makes me so sad, because I guess it feels a lot more extreme, when you talk about serial killers or just one-off murders, it seems a lot smaller.
It was one person was bad.
Yeah.
But if you're talking about a genocide or a war, then it's
lots
the entire situation was bad.
Yeah.
And a lot of this is one specific story in a whole bunch of stories that are really horrible.
Mm-hmm.
And just gets you down a lot. Yeah.
Sad. And I really wish that I was able to find a lot more about what he did in his life, because he sounds he had a pretty interesting life, being a lawyer and a journalist. I wonder what he wrote about.
And a freedom fighter.
Yeah.
As well. Yeah.
Alrighty. Off to Mexico we shall go.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So I'm taking you to Mexico. And my case this week is not the best. It's very sad. And it's not really a one-off case. It's a whole bunch of, it's hard to explain, but it's a whole bunch of different cases entwined into one. And it's larger than I could cover on the podcast. So I'm going to recommend some books that really deep dive into this case at the end. But I'm doing the femicides of Ciudad Juarez. Excuse my pronunciation if you're from Mexico.
Part of me feels I know this, but I don't know the name of it, so we'll see.
You might recognize it as the Juarez Ripper.
Possibly. We'll see how far we get into the case before I figure out if I know it or not.
So my sources this week are 2020 L article by Rose Minutaglio, a 2003 Texas Monthly article by Cecilia Bali, the Red Note podcast, Wikipedia, the Criminal Minds Wiki, a 1993 Guardian article by Mary Beth Sheridan, theconversation.com, and NPR. So, Tegan, you've talked about femicide a couple times on the podcast, and unfortunately, femicide is a massive issue in Mexico as well. As a reminder, femicide is the murder of a woman just because she is a woman, often by someone she knows or a loved one. In the past 5 years in Mexico, incidents of femicide in Mexico have increased by 137%. Incidents of femicide have increased exponentially in 2020 due to the coronavirus pandemic and many women being forced to stay at home with their abusers. In the first 4 months of 2020 alone, there were nearly 1,000 women killed in Mexico. April 2020 was the deadliest month in the past 5 years for women in Mexico, with 267 women being murdered. Just like in South Africa, as you covered a couple months ago, the issue in Mexico has been described as the country's second pandemic. Throughout the past few years, even before the pandemic, women across Mexico have been protesting to demand justice for murdered women and girls. In 2019, the government promised that the safety of women and girls in Mexico would be a top priority. However, many women feel as though the president of Mexico, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, does not care. In March of 2020, at the beginning of the pandemic, there were over 26,000 women that called the National Domestic Abuse Helpline. The president, however, said that, quote, 90% of those calls are fake, unquote. So.
Are you kidding me?
Yeah. He was like, yeah, there's like 26,000 calls, but like, you know, 90% of those are just women being dramatic. No.
I can tell that this is gonna make me angry.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
So, protests and the push for justice against femicide have been going on since the crisis first erupted onto international headlines in the 1990s, when an alarming number of women and girls were murdered in the northern Mexican town of Ciudad Juarez. Nearly 400 women and girls were murdered in the town, or in the city, rather, in the 90s and early 2000s, and this is what I will be covering today, the femicides of Ciudad Juarez. So, quickly about Ciudad Juarez, or just Juarez, or Juarez, again, sorry for my pronunciation. Juarez is a town in northern Mexico, just south of the U.S.-Mexico border with Texas. Juarez literally straddles the border alongside El Paso, Texas, which is right in the western corner of the state of Texas. If there wasn't an international border there, it would certainly just be one big city. Ciudad Juarez is the fourth largest city in Mexico. The city was subject to wars between cartels, and at the height of this war, more than 3,000 people were killed. Just to give an example of how dangerous this city can be, in the podcast The Red Note, which I listened to in my research for this case, you hear gunshots during an interview within the first 3 minutes of the podcast.
Oh my God, that's insane.
Mm-hmm. Many women end up in Juarez because they come north to immigrate to the USA, but instead get stuck in Juarez. Many of these women become victims of rape, kidnapping, sex trafficking, and murder. A couple key factors are attributed to the femicides of Ciudad Juarez in the 1990s. Cartels, gender roles, the maquiladora, or factory industry, and NAFTA. In 1993, Juarez became a major drug trafficking center as global politics shifted and Colombian cartels began to move drugs through the U.S.-Mexico border towns. In addition, right around the time the femicides began, a cartel leader was assassinated and replaced with a new, more brutal and corrupt leader who really seemed to have everyone in his pocket, meaning that many officials may have turned a blind eye to the murders because they were on the cartel's payroll. The establishment of NAFTA, or the North America Free Trade Agreement, encouraged the culture and industry of maquiladoras. The maquiladora industry strengthened as a result of NAFTA, and as a result, put many more women in danger. So, maquiladoras are factories, and they offered NAFTA a cheap labor and cheap exports from Mexico. With Juarez being straddled on the border of Texas and Mexico, this was a prime spot for manufacturing because they could quickly just hop it right across the border, but the American companies could use these maquiladoras for cheap labor. Mainly women work in the maquiladoras with men bosses who often sexually harassed their workers and abused their power. In Juarez, over 80% of the maquiladora workers were women and girls. Girls would also lie about their age to get jobs at these maquiladoras as well. Instead of being 18 years old, many were as young as 12 or 13 and working at the factories. And because of gender roles in Mexico at the time, this was kind of like a new industry where women and girls could work. You know, classic, like women mainly work in informal economy or labor jobs like this because gender roles dignify that they can't have higher positions of power. But the expansion of the maquiladora industry due to NAFTA meant that women across Mexico were migrating north in search of work, coming to Juarez to work in the maquiladoras. These circumstances, along with other events and factors, are what made these femicides possible. Women were vulnerable, working low wages in an environment that was already dangerous with the cartels and a culture of machismo. As a result, the femicide rates skyrocketed. In 1993, women in the city of Juarez began to go missing and getting murdered at rates that locals just could not ignore. Girls went missing so frequently that locals banded together and just went out to search the desert and mountains outside town, trying to find bodies of the missing. As more and more women and girls turned up dead, many of them were similar. Many were between 13 and 22 years old. Many were thin, with long dark hair and curtain bangs. Most were students, sex industry workers, informal economy workers, or factory maquiladora workers. Many of these women had never even been reported missing. Many of them were migrants and did not have an extensive network in Juarez out looking for them. Even more so, many of these women and girls' deaths were not investigated thoroughly by the police. As stated in the Red Note podcast, often much of the investigating was left up to the girls' mothers. Many people suspected that the cartels were responsible, but others became increasingly worried that Juarez had a serial killer on their hands. A couple years later, in the mid-1990s, a man named Oscar Maynez began looking into the murders. Maynez was a forensic pathologist and professor at the State Police Academy who was looking through murder cases to train investigators with, but instead he found all of these cases of murdered women and noticed many similarities across many of the cases. Diving deeper into the cases, he realized something more organized just had to be happening. Many of the women found in the desert had identical patterns of injuries. They had been raped, strangled with their necks broken, and stabbed. Many of the women found had their right breast severed off and their left nipple bitten off. Maynez realized that this must be the signature of a serial killer.
Can I just say that how did that many women have that signature mark and nobody put it together? Yeah. And also, that is disgusting. Like, I think that, nothing really makes me queasy other than hearing about, female body parts being mutilated.
Yeah.
Like,
because you can, you hear it and you're like, oh, I kind of feel it.
Yeah. Like, it also seems so much more sadistic, I think. Because it's like,
yeah,
you're destroying the parts of this woman who make them women. Like, what's so bad about us?
And also you're destroying the part that you have sexualized.
Yeah.
So you are punishing the woman's body for because of your own sexualization of her body.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Ugh, makes me so angry.
I know.
And sick.
So Maynez also discovered a distinct victimology of these cases. The victims seemed to be carefully selected, with most of them being migrants, not originally from Juarez. Like I said, women with not too many friends in the city. Maynez compiled all of these cases and created a report and a suspect profile. He decided it was most likely a lone serial killer, and he delivered his report, the profile, and the victimology, and sent it to the state prosecutor. But he did not hear anything back. He tried to reach the prosecutor, and when he finally did, the prosecutor denied and minimized the issue and then blamed the victims. They were out past 8 p.m. What were they wearing? What were they doing? Were they up to trouble? Were they sex workers? In one case, the prosecutor and, I guess, the government of the state of Chihuahua blamed the murder of an 11-year-old schoolgirl on her parents because they did not give her enough milk, and thus they were neglecting her.
You have got to be kidding me right now.
No.
It just makes me so angry because, and especially with, what's going on right now, things clearly are not getting better for women around the world. Like, it's honestly getting worse.
Yeah, the past 2 weeks, since it was, International Women's Day, just struck a nerve with all of these misogynist men, and they all decided to band together and, react so severely to all of the social media discourse about violence against women.
Yeah.
With the whole 97% of women experience sexual assault or sexual harassment throughout their life.
Did you see that TikTok? Some girl was getting out of her car and these two guys walked over to her and said, do you want to make it 98%?
What?
Yeah. And then we're following her and her friend into a store.
Within the past week, in our city alone, I know of two women who were being followed. There was that one who went viral on social media because a man followed her for 40 minutes, walking very closely behind her, and she filmed the whole thing, and he obviously did not care that he was being filmed.
He followed my friend. I posted it on my story, and my friend reached out to me and said that she had also been followed by that man and had to go to transit security to get him to stop following her.
And then my sister's friend, she was out walking her dog in her own neighborhood and didn't take her phone with her because you feel safe in your own neighborhood. She noticed this guy was following her and she doubled back a couple times and he was following her. And then she turned around and told him, "Excuse me, please stop following me," like very loudly. And luckily, a woman in an apartment building that she was outside of heard that and came out to stand with her. It's like, I don't understand how so many men don't, it's like, we're telling you that this is all happening and they're like, oh, I don't think it's that often. It's like, I literally know every single woman I know has had a story about a man sexually harassing them, following them, stalking them, making them severely uncomfortable, trying to harm them in some way. It's like,
yeah. But none of the men that we know have done anything.
Hopefully.
Well, how is that possible if every single woman we know has had something happen to them and none of the men we know have contributed, apparently.
Yeah.
It's sad. Okay, yeah. Anyways, back to your case and maybe we'll talk more about this later.
Yeah. Okay, so after that big sidebar, over time, pressure mounted on Juarez officials to find the murderers of these young women and girls. Public outcry increased and increased as more and more women and girls disappeared. The first break in the case came in October of 1995. A 19-year-old sex worker named Blanca Estela Diaz came forward and reported a brutal rape and kidnapping to the police. She came to the police after escaping her kidnapper out of a bathroom window and running to a neighbor's house in the wealthy San Marcos area of Juarez. Blanca had been held for multiple days at the home of 42-year-old Abdel Latif Sharif Sharif. Sharif was from Egypt and had immigrated to the U.S. and worked in the oil and gas sector as a chemist. Sharif was attractive and intelligent, but a violent man. He had lived in the U.S. for some time and had racked up quite the record. Sharif was fired after being charged with a series of sex crimes throughout the 1980s in the U.S. He had served time in prison for the vicious beating and rape of a nursing student in Florida. And before that, he'd been arrested and then released on parole after kidnapping and raping a woman after tricking her into being hired as his quote-unquote housekeeper. This guy was really horrible to women, and I have no idea why he was allowed to be released and reoffended nearly 5 times throughout his 21 years in the U.S., but he was finally deported and moved to Mexico in the early 1990s. Police in Mexico arrested Sharif for Blanca's rape and kidnapping, but was ultimately released soon after, quote-unquote, not finding evidence of sexual abuse on Blanca. But to make it more horrible, Blanca alleges that police raped her at the police station after she reported her rape and kidnapping. So perhaps there was no evidence because the police did not want to indict themselves for her rape as well. But after hearing about Sharif's arrest, women started to come forward to report that they had allegedly seen Sharif with other victims, particularly a 17-year-old victim named Elizabeth Castro Garcia. Apparently, only like 20 minutes after Sharif's initial release, police arrested him again, this time for the murder of Elizabeth. Elizabeth had gone missing 2 or 3 months before in August 1995, and a body that matched her description was found soon after. Sharif had reportedly been in a relationship with Elizabeth at the time of her disappearance, so he's not only a rapist, but he is a pedophile because she was 17 years old and he was 42. But then while Sharif was in custody, Elizabeth turned up alive. The body that they had found in the desert that matched her description was of a different woman, Silvia Rivera Salas, who disappeared in March of 1995. Silvia had been reported by witnesses as being kidnapped off the street by 2 men in a van. So Sharif was charged with Silvia's murder instead. He was convicted in 1996 and sentenced to 30 years in prison for Silvia's murder, and while in prison, his murder charges kept racking up. Eventually, police had charged him with the murders of 17 women in the Juarez area, and many were convinced that he was the serial killer that Oscar Maynez had theorized. The problem, though, was that while Sharif was in prison, women kept going missing and kept turning up dead, their bodies abandoned in the desert outside Juarez. In the 6 months after Sharif's arrest, another 12 femicides were recorded in Juarez. Police then claimed that Sharif was somehow controlling a group of serial killers called the Ciudad Juarez Rebels from jail. Police claimed that Sharif had hired them to divert the investigation away from Sharif and prove that he was innocent when he was actually guilty. Whether or not Sharif is actually guilty of the murders, we do not know. Pressure was mounting on police and officials to find the killer, and Sharif is obviously an easy target. He's an outsider, a foreigner who does not speak Spanish. He has a history of violent sexual assaults in the U.S., but Sharif always proclaimed his innocence and claimed that police had bribed witnesses to give false statements in order to convict him. His arrest and conviction stirred controversy about how there wasn't really much evidence to convict him of the murders and that he was simply just a government scapegoat. Sharif died in prison in 2006 after suffering a heart attack. Throughout the 1990s, there were multiple one-off arrests and convictions. Some arrested claimed to have been paid off by Sharif, but this has never been truly verified, and Sharif said that police paid them to implicate him. But even with arrests of local gang members or others, the murders continued. There have been many theories as to if there was actually a serial killer operating in Juarez, now known as the Juarez Ripper. There are multiple suspects other than Sharif, many of which were arrested and convicted for murders in Juarez, but nobody has really been able to officially state them as serial killers and as the serial killer that Oscar Maynez discovered. As of 2003, there were over 370 known victims of the femicides of Ciudad Juarez, and the number is still climbing today at an alarming rate. In 2020, before the month of January was even half over, there were 64 homicides just in Juarez. Many, if not most of these victims, were women. So that is the femicides of Juarez. It doesn't have an ending, really, but I wanted to cover this case just because of the sheer injustice women are facing in Juarez. So I'll recommend some further reading if you're interested and if you want to know more. So the Red Note podcast that I mentioned, I highly suggest it. It provides firsthand accounts and interviews some of the victims' friends and family, and it's a 10-part series. They have it both in English and in Spanish. There's also the Killing Fields book about the murders and a book, The Daughters of Juarez. So that is my case this week.
That is absolutely insane.
Yeah.
Not the case that I was thinking of. I was thinking of the elderly women who were murdered, and no one thought that it was a serial killer.
It's like the abuela murderer or something like that.
Yeah. Oh my god. It just makes me so angry. Yeah. I one of my guy friends, when I posted that story about the girl being followed, he was like, "Men are scum." I was like, yeah. And I was like, you know, like, we were talking about it, and he was like, yeah, no, like, I'm definitely, like, trying to work on, you know, if I hear people say things that are inappropriate, that I stop them from saying that. He's like, but I could never be friends with anyone who treats women that way. He's like, I'm so sorry that you all have to go through that. Like, I wish that there was something more that I could do other than just, like, looking out for, you know, people saying things. So
it's all be a vigilante.
Yeah. Yeah, but it's just like, I think it's so insane, and it's so sad that, like, this has, like, really come up from just, like, being around International Women's Day. Like, it's...
Yeah. There was the murder of Sarah Everard in the UK, and that, like, kicked off right on International Women's Day is when it kind of went globally viral.
Yeah, and it was... Then there was that huge backlash from, like, all men.
Yeah, like, what?
Ay.
Again, it makes me feel sad for humanity.
Yeah. It's just disappointing.
But Harry Styles would never, right?
He literally could never, ever, ever do anything like that. I love him. So we all know Harry performed at the Grammys. Harry won Grammy. We all saw the looks from the Grammys. I'm looking at my TV right now because my roommate and I went for drinks on Friday night, and I came home and made her watch the Grammy performance, and there's literally hand marks down the TV.
Oh my God.
Because clearly I had a couple drinks and was just like...
You just wanted to touch Harry
through
like, the TV.
Amazing. But yeah, oh my God. The amount of content that we got from that one night, it's just chef's kiss. I love him.
Yeah, he kind of like disappears and then reappears in like a public performance or public appearance and then kind of disappears and reappears.
He's very private.
He keeps guessing.
Yeah. That little dance though that he did during the performance. Did you watch the performance?
I haven't watched the whole thing yet.
Megan.
He's I don't know where to watch it.
On YouTube?
Oh, okay. I obviously just like did not care to Google it.
I can't connect to the Wi-Fi network. You might want to check the connection settings in the Google Home app.
Shut up, Alexa.
You mean Google.
Sorry, Google.
He's like singing and then he goes over to his like backup singers and like shuffles back to them and then does this little dance and then like spins and turns around and then moves back to his microphone.
Oh, yeah, I've seen that bit.
Oh my God. That's all I've got to say. The little... Nothing is more beautiful to me than that. So yeah, I really feel like that's like all I can say about Harry right now is that he's a gorgeous man and I love him.
That's the Harry Styles update corner from this episode, I guess.
Yeah. We love him. That's the update. I just recently started watching a series on Netflix called Murder Among the Mormons.
Oh, I started it, but then I had to like stop it because of something, but...
I am like halfway through I've got 11 minutes left of the third episode, which is the final episode, and it is so good. I'm not sure if anyone knows the case. I think my favorite murder covered it, so I kind of was familiar with it before starting to watch it, but it's definitely an interesting one that you should go watch because it's crazy.
Like, 'cause isn't it like... documents start to surface proving that the Church of Mormonism or like the Latter-day Saints or whatever is like not
there's Mormons, there's forgeries, there's lies, there's bombs, there's just everything. He was not a good man.
The leader of the church?
No, it's not. It has nothing to do with the leader of the church.
Oh, okay.
It is about a guy who was raised as a Mormon who finds these Mormon artifacts. And apparently the Mormon church is just like obsessed with themselves and want like all of the information that they can find about like relics from their past. So they pay a whole bunch of money for it and... they find out at the end that they're not actually true. All the money that they spent on these artifacts that they bought from this man are actually all fakes that he made. So I've been watching that. I've been watching Parks and Rec. I've been watching Superstore. There's also another one that I just started watching, which is really great. It is called Self-Made, inspired the light of the life of Madame C.J. Walker. It is really good. I would highly recommend it. It's a limited series, so there's only 4 episodes.
Oh, good. It's my favorite kind of series.
But it is about a woman making her own hair product for Black women and her life of like trying to make it in the world and kind of working against a different black woman who was very unkind to her, and her like struggling to like show that all black women's lives kind of are, you know, they all are equal and not just like the light skinned ones who are super super pretty can't be equal to, you know, just the average woman, I guess.
Trying to combat the culture of colorism.
Yeah.
Is it on Netflix?
It's on Netflix. It's a Netflix original series, and it has Octavia Spencer, Tiffany Haddish in it, and it is so good. I love Octavia Spencer. She's amazing.
I watched The Silence of the Lambs last night for the first time.
How did you like it?
Have you seen it?
I've fallen asleep every single time I've watched it.
It's definitely like a slow burn.
Yeah.
But it's very interesting. The actor that plays Hannibal Lecter plays Hannibal Lecter so good. Like, he's so creepy in it. He does like the Kubrick stare where he like tilts his forehead forward and like looks at her like without blinking.
Megan and I are
his eyebrows.
Doing it right now.
Yeah, it's so creepy. But it is very interesting.
Yeah, I feel like I always fall asleep like halfway through the movie and then I wake up at the end. So I know what happens, but yeah. I feel like it's kind of sacrilegious that I have never actually finished fully watching Silence of the Lambs. Because I feel like it's just like one of those that if you're into true crime, you've seen it.
Do you know where like Hannibal Lecter originated? Was it from that movie? Like Hannibal the Cannibal?
I think it's based on real life. I don't know.
Oh, what? Apparently he's from Lithuania. I googled, where did Hannibal Lecter come from? It's like Lithuania. Okay. Oh, yeah. Alfredo Bali Trevino, the killer doctor who inspired the character Hannibal Lecter, is based on a Mexican doctor who murdered his boyfriend in 1959. Huh.
Yeesh. Have you been watching anything else recently?
I don't think so. I've been watching Superstore. I've decided to like pick back up making earrings because I stopped for a little bit.
Nice, nice.
So I started again and I'm trying to figure out how to sell them. And I like probably could set up like a Shopify website or just sell on Etsy or whatever. But the problem is the packaging. Because shipping is so expensive in Canada that even like one pair of earrings might be like $12 to send. So it's like, I don't want to charge like more than I might be charging for the product in shipping.
How is that even possible?
Because it's like, I don't think it can fit in an envelope. So the next thing would be like a small mailer envelope. And it's like, like, the minimum through Canada Post is, like, $12 for that. So it's like, well, how do small businesses do this?
You can't use, like, a, like one of those, like, file mail, like, the, like, brownish kind of envelopes?
Maybe. I don't know. I've been looking at, like, shipping rates, and I, like, tried to do the calculate my shipping on CanadaPost.com, and it was, like, $12. It was, like, this is literally 30 grams.
Yeah, that's insane.
Less than that. So I have to, like, sort that out.
In more news from Tegan, I am killing it with my plants right now. Like, I don't think you understand. I had a Monstera that was dying. I feel like I've talked about it before. It had root rot. I saved it. It now has 3 new leaves. And another shoot is coming out right now.
Whoa.
I know. And then I propagated like 8 clippings of my pothos plant. And they're all doing marvelous. They've all grown massive roots. So I'm like, I've got like a water soil mixture that I'm making right now. Because their roots are too soft. To just go directly into soil, so you kind of have to like slowly do that. But off the plant that I've clipped them all off of, I've got like 8 or 9 new leaves coming in.
Wow.
And then on my peace lily, I've got like 3 new leaves coming out. So I'm clearly killing it.
That is completely opposite to my plants. My plants are not doing very well. I need to like repot them all because the soil is probably like denitrogenated. Whatever.
I got some like nitrogen sticks from like Garden Works, and they're just like little sticks that you like put in the soil. That might help nitrogenate it.
All my plants like stopped growing throughout the winter, so
yeah.
Hopefully they start again.
Also at Costco, I got 2 new books. I got like the burn it after you finish writing it thing. So you're supposed to like, it's like a book where you like fill in a whole bunch of like prompts and stuff. And then you're supposed to like burn it after you finish. It's kind of like
a release, like therapeutic.
Yeah. And then I can't see it, but it's like why women can't sleep.
Oh.
It's been like on the top of like.
It's because we gotta keep an eye out for Selene or.
I have to grab it. I was close. It's called Why We Can't Sleep, A Woman's New Midlife Crisis. I mean, I can't sleep, so.
Because they took Forensic Files off of Netflix.
Yeah, exactly. Quite rude, to be honest. I'm still angry about that. The dedication in the book is for the middle-aged women of America. You're not imagining it. It's not just you.
If only we were middle-aged women in America. But we're not.
Nope. We're just Zillennials struggling to find our way through life.
What do you prefer, Zillennials or Millennial Z?
Zillennials.
I feel like Millennial Z sounds like something fun.
Yeah, like it sounds like,
like futuristic.
Yeah, like one of those like futuristic games that like they marketed to like little kids. Like moon boots and stuff.
Fun!
Okay. Well,
let's pull some countries.
Let's pull some countries.
Okay, Tegan, do you want to know where you're going?
Yes, please.
You're going to Croatia.
Oh, we're sticking to Eastern Europe. I've always wanted to go to Croatia.
Yeah, it seems so pretty.
Mm-hmm.
Not seems, like it looks very pretty.
From the photos that we've seen, it seems very pretty.
Okay, and I... guess where I'm going. I'll give you one guess. You're not gonna get it, but I'll give you one guess.
Can you give me a continent?
North America, Caribbean. Like, so North and Central America.
Yeah. Trinidad and Tobago.
I'm going to Cuba.
Ooh.
Cuba. I don't know why I said it so proper.
Cuba.
I'm trying way too hard. Cuba. Okay. Well, that's that. Thank you for listening and joining us on the podcast again. Follow us on Instagram at Destination Murder Pod, Facebook Destination Murder, Twitter at Dest_Murder. Check out our show notes for more information and our sources and photos. And we will be in your ear holes next week. Goodbye.
Ma assalamani.
Ma salamati. I did that one as well.
Yeah.
For Lebanon, I think. Ma salamati.
Ma salamati.
Okay, and adios.
Oh, adios, amigo. I keep forgetting where you're going. I'm like, Megan.
Get together. If you're listening for the first time and you're confused, we always end off the podcast by saying goodbye in the language of the country that we were just in.
Yeah.
So, adios. Ma salamat.
Ma salamat.